If you're trying to figure out how to navigate the tricky tightrope of parenting while you have questions, doubts, and wonderings about your spiritual journey, our podcast is for you.
It doesn't matter if your kids are smalls, middles, or bigs. We'll explore what and how we're deconstructing from churchianity, harmful belief systems, and diving deep into the ways we can work this out in parenthood.
We're also going to work through ideas for reconstructing a space for our families to thrive under new systems of love and freedom.
We can't wait to bring you some hope that you're not alone and that it's really okay, even good, to explore all the possibilities that may have felt closed off in the past.
Our podcast is going to offer you grace and space to be exactly where you are and who you are.
We're really glad you're here, and we're excited for today's episode. Listen in.
Deconstruction invites us to become really honest about what we believe, why we hold those beliefs sacred, how they influence the way we relate to our Creator, and who is actually served by our beliefs. If we trust the process enough to lower our walls and honestly engage with our questions, deconstruction promises to reveal undiscovered biases, limiting beliefs, and any flawed doctrines that actively harm people. That quote is by Angela Harrington in her new book, Deconstructing Your Faith Without Losing Yourself.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. Today, we're talking with Angela Harrington. You might remember her. We had her on before episode 20. Angela is a faith deconstruction coach, Mama 5. She's a writer. And today, we're going to talk with her a little bit about her new book, Deconstructing Your Faith Without Losing Yourself. And so we are overjoyed to have you back, Angela. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me again. It kind of feels like coming home. That's always a good thing.
Oh, I love that.
That is.
It's fun. It's fun when you can do like a second interview and you can uncover even like more things about, you know, the journey and the person that you are. And we're just really excited to talk about your book. So can you talk to us a little bit about how your life has changed in some of the big and small ways? What does your day look like? What does your family look like nowadays? And then outside of some of that stuff, what makes your heart come alive?
Yeah. So the biggest change is of course the book. This is my first book. And so this whole thing for the last 2 years has really been a learning process of like, it's a slow simmering process. It's not like you write a book and it goes out into the world in 2 weeks, right? So there's been a lot of learning. There's been a lot of patience building there for me. I've taken a short sabbatical from coaching, decided to take about 6 months off just to care for myself and recenter. I've been doing this work for over a decade. And so that, again, that's really a gift. And it's also really challenging, like not to get up and hustle it out every day was a new experience for me. Family-wise, my kids have gotten older. We've got one that we sent off to college this fall, not too far away, about 45 minutes away. But you know, that's a really beautiful thing. So I've got two that have grown and flown. I've got one that's in college, and then I've got two in high school. So I've got a freshman and a junior. And I think the last time we talked, my littlest was still in middle school, and it's beautiful, but boy, there's a difference between eighth grade and freshman. So it's been so joyful to have the two youngest at the same school again, because even though there's 2 years between them, when they get in sync, they're like twins. Like, it is so much fun, and they travel in the same friend groups. They do the same sports. And so it's just a very sweet season. We're looking at colleges. We're talking about what it's going to be like to be empty nesters, because I brought two kiddos into the marriage with me. So it's never just been my husband and I. So there's just lots of really sweet stuff happening, which is great in the chaos of the world right now. It's nice to have these little pockets of dumb little insider jokes and teasing and talking about classes and just all kinds of stuff like that. So this is so wild. I love documentaries, right? So of course, I've watched almost all the religious cult ones. They're super fascinating. I've always loved that type of documentary where you can see how people work. But I got to tell you, I love murder mystery documentaries. But there's a catch. They have to have caught the bad guy. Mm. Because if you give me this great story and then they're like, yeah, this person is still out, No, I'm not sleeping that night, right? But like, I want to know that if everything else in the world goes haywire, at least we're still catching some bad guys.
Oh, I love that.
So you want it to be a true story, like a
Yes.
true murders,
Yes.
not mysteries, not just like, hey, Agatha Christie wrote a murder mystery and we all know it's going to be wrapped up. You
Yeah.
want true crime. I'm a murder mystery ridiculous person. My husband joked that I can only read a book with a dead body at the beginning.
I love that.
But I can do fake. I can't do as much real as, but you like the real. That's so fun.
I do. And it's probably because I cut my teeth on Agatha Christie. I have read every Hardy Boys, every Nancy Drew, Trixie Belden, Tom Swift, even go back to Tom Swift, who's like Hardy Boys, but his dad worked at NASA. So there was like this whole space theme, like Encyclopedia Brown, like all of those. That's what I grew up on, and Hitchcock movies and the old BBC mystery type things. And so I absolutely love those. It's hard to sometimes find that vibe in contemporary shows. And so I think that's why I love being able to watch some of the Netflix, the British mystery shows, because
Yes.
they're more my pace. Like, you gotta be smart if you're gonna keep me engaged for an hour and a half, much less a six-part series. So that's
You watch Dead to Me? I mean, not a documentary, but de the show Dead to Me?
yes, that's the one with Christina Applegate. Oh my gosh, that was amazing.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, my husband, I really like that. I wouldn't say that I'm a super huge like murder mystery person. I don't go out of my way to find them, but I always end up sort of enjoying them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah. Right.
yeah, I love that.
I can watch a show like Criminal Minds, which is about serial killers, and
Yeah.
go right to sleep. I
Same.
can fall asleep to a serial killer show.
That's wild, Esther.
I know. I it is not normal,
Yeah.
but I do have kind of strange dreams, so perhaps.
Yeah, I was on bed rest with my third kiddo, the one that just went off to college, and Netflix wasn't a thing yet. We didn't have any streaming services. I couldn't go out to like get videos or anything. But I tell you what, Law and Order was like six episodes a day,
Yes.
and then they would repeat it. So if I like
Yes.
fell asleep during one, I was kind of like able to gauge time by, oh, wait, I saw this one earlier today.
Law and Order, every single episode I've watched on
Yes.
all of the
Yeah,
ones.
Law and Order
On all.
SVU, that's true.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my goodness. That's awesome. Just as a deconstructing and parenting aside, my firstborn, so I was very, very evangelical, religious, uptight with my firstborn. She could not watch That's So Raven, which was about a wizard. When she was 13, by my last born, we were watching Law and Order SVU when she was 13.
That's funny.
I mean, that should just show you how quickly you can deconstruct your toxic religious system.
You know, I remember when I was a little kid or a young person, I wasn't allowed to watch like PG movies for a long time or like PG-13. And it didn't really matter what the movie was about. If it had the letters, it was like, forget about it. And when the Barbie movie came out, my daughter was like, wanted to see the Barbie movie. She's six. She loves Barbie, whatever, right? So I went to see it with my friends in theaters. And I was like, a lot of this stuff is going to be over her head, but I don't think it's going to be overly harmful. It's PG-13, right? So we ended up renting it, and my daughter and I watched it together. And she just felt like, I mean, so much was over her head, but she felt so big, so adult, something she was doing with mommy. And I remember sitting on the couch and thinking, like, I would have never been allowed to do this because of the letters, and everyone has their own, right? Like, I know a lot of moms that were like, we're not doing that, and that's fine, right? Like, this was just my personal journey with my daughter, but I wouldn't have been allowed to watch that because of those letters at the beginning of the movie, regardless of what. Yeah, anyways, it's just interesting what can be healing for yourself. Like, that was very healing for me in its own way.
Yeah.
But Angela, I love that you are taking this sort of like sabbatical for yourself. I get really giddy about self-care. Like, Esther knows this about me. I just get so giddy about it. I just want everybody to do self-care. Like, I just want everybody to take time for themselves. I don't know. I just get giddy for it. And so I'm wondering what you have found out about yourself when you've let go of some of that hustle of work life? Like, what have you found about yourself in the stillness or the silence of some of those moments where you're not doing what you were doing?
Yeah, I think the biggest kind of self-discovery piece has been how much I struggle to establish the right amount of routine. So not so rigid and like legalistic, but also not just chaotic, fly by the seat of my pants. When we go on a road trip, we plan certain pieces and then we leave like 70% open, right? And that totally works for us. But I don't naturally know, and I didn't have the conditioning to know how to do that in the day to day. And so, especially having PTSD and bipolar and some real lengthy mental health history, it's so important to not swing to either extreme. And I think taking this break reminded me that how much I rely on outside sources to set that routine. So I even did some grant management. I had a short stint where it was kind of like a 9-to-5 job and my routines were great. Like, I was thriving. And then that wrapped up right before Christmas. And we all know routine and Christmas are just not a thing. Like, it doesn't happen. And so as I'm coming into this new year, there's still like, how do I get my feet under me and do the work that I love to do without going into that like hustle 24/7 vibe that physically and emotionally harms me? Because I know I don't want to go back there. I know I don't want to do nothing.
Right.
Middle ground is really hard.
I heard something that you're saying there, which might describe a little bit about where you've come from and where you're trying to go, maybe, and all of us are, and I am, is that shift from external authority to internal authority.
Yeah.
And I would say that that is a major path for people who are deconstructing, because we've been told what to think, how to think, that other people have authority over us. Mm-hmm. And then now we're in this new space. Maybe we don't have church, or like you said, you're taking a sabbatical. All those external things that hold us and tell us what to do. Now we have free reign, quote unquote, to sin and do debauchery. I'm just kidding.
That's slippery slope. Here we go.
But that it is the more like that you call it the water slide that leads to life, but that's a more free place. And so I guess before we head into our specific questions about your book, can you talk a little bit with us about the shift from external authority to internal authority?
Yeah, I feel like you should have my therapist on for this part because we talked about this a lot. And I think the biggest moment for me was learning about secure attachment and insecure attachment and learning about how my desire for, and my drive, that's probably a better word, my drive for approval and external validation wasn't just like a personality trait I was always going to have. It was actually my trauma response. So if the two of you, while we're doing this interview, in my old frame of mind, if the two of you seem to be happy with what I'm doing, I'm safe. But if you're not happy with what I'm doing in this conversation, that's when my nervous system is kind of like, do we get on the on-ramp? Do we like ramp up? So part of this book even stemmed from those therapy conversations about learning how to become securely attached to myself. And I say this as someone who has really good parents, like just really good parents. But the truth is, we can only pass on what we know or what we're willing to learn. And so, you know, I can go back through the generations and I can see where there were some issues that really challenged my family over the last 100, 150 years. And the result of that is that we lose little pieces of a whole relationship looks like, and wholeness as individuals. And so I think the biggest shift with that is learning how to just completely turn the volume down on those conversations in my head or externally that are saying, if people are mad at you, that's a you issue. Like, if people are mad at me, that's a me issue and I need to hustle. I need to do something to fix it, because that's not the truth, right? That's codependency. That's me being an enabler or being a people pleaser. And so, going into book launch, I'm really glad I learned that because book launches are beautiful, but there's going to be
Yep,
critics.
there always are.
There's going to be critics.
There's going to be critics. They're already starting to pop out of the woodwork.
I don't want to like go down a complete tangent,
Yeah.
but I heard you sort of talk a little bit about that idea of like generational trauma and like
Yeah.
some of the things that didn't happen to us, right? That are but are in our DNA and the collective nervous system has like adopted.
Right.
And I've been really interested in this topic in general, and I think it can be really important when we're working through our own trauma, when we feel like, wait, but I had really good parents. What is wrong with me? Why am I like this? Because I just think it can be really important when we're confused about why we are the way that we are.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that as much as you want?
Sure.
And then we're going to dive right into your book.
Yeah.
But I love this tangent.
Yeah, okay, good.
Well, and it's not even a tangent because it's in the book. Like it's,
Oh, good. Okay.
in the book we talk about mothering, and I'm not using mothering in like the patriarchal, 1950s housewife. It's not that context. It's mothering as in this like archetype, this nurturing, life-giving, caregiving sort of entity, if you will. And I think the key to healing generational trauma is learning how to mother ourselves and heal our own wounds wherever possible with the support of therapy and coaching and all those, the medicines, all those things, right? It's not that we're doing it all alone. But we're learning how to turn this nurturing that we give so freely to other people inward to ourselves. And
Yes.
I mean, for me, and I think we might have even talked about this last time, for me, one of the biggest catalysts for this was looking at my daughter and saying, what do I actually want for you? And if I don't want things for you, why am I tolerating them for me? Right? Like, why am I creating them for me? And so, like, when we talk about generational trauma, sometimes it's not a big thing. Like, it's not a divorce. It's not a death. It's not a tragic accident. It's not a war. Like, sometimes it's not big like that. Sometimes it's just living your whole life right on the edge of not having your needs met, right? Always being in that activated, that your nervous system is always activated. Sometimes it is catastrophic. So the 45-second version of a lot of the generational trauma that I've worked through is that in the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918, half of my great grandmother's family died, including her mother and her older sister, who was also like 14 or something, and she was in a mothering role. So the two mothering figures that she had were gone, and she's a toddler at this point. Went to an orphanage. She and her surviving sister were split up. Her brother was sent to another family. And so, like, hi, trauma. You don't have that, you don't have that relationship with your mother. Her father died a couple of years later, and she was never reunited with her sister until adulthood. Then they got to spend some time together. So, like, you could just imagine how that ripples out over the last, what, 110 years at this point, 105. And then you go into COVID. And it's like everybody on the news is talking about the Spanish flu. Everyone on the news is talking about grief. And thankfully, I had done some of that work ahead of time because it was really hard on me and my parents and like extended family, right? Because like this wasn't new to us. In January of 2020, like we knew what a pandemic was and we knew the potential cost for it. And so being able to heal and just grieve for people who probably never got a chance to grieve, like we know how to grieve today, right? Like people who didn't have a therapist, right? People who didn't have life coaches and people who just didn't have the tremendous amount of privilege that we have right now. Being able to go sit on my great grandmother's grave, being able to sit on her mother's grave and cry with them and cry in ways that women who were born in the teens didn't have permission to cry. Being able to go to my great great grandfather's grave and tell him it was okay that he wasn't there when it happened. And even though there's no reason to forgive him, say, we forgive you. It's okay. And know that if no one else ever hears those words, my soul heard those words. My cells heard those words.
That is powerful.
I have sticks and I have rocks and I have pictures that I'm surrounded by pictures of my great grandmothers who were incredibly strong and also didn't have permission to grieve, didn't have permission to be emotional, and so didn't have permission to heal in a lot of ways that we can today. Some people will say this is weird and woo, but I think it's also biblical and I think it's also human nature, and we see it in other religions too. Literally, your story doesn't start with you. My story did not start with me. My daughter's story did not start with her. We're a product of all of this conditioning. And so I think that being able to turn that nurturing into ourselves and heal ourselves, of course, it'll go to future generations.
Of course.
But from my own humble personal experience, I have seen and felt things that I know sent healing backwards too.
When you actually start to experience it for yourself.
Yeah.
And like you said, when you go back and you start to unpack some of the things that were happening for these family members, my dad's side of the family, it was like World War II, prisoners of war,
Yep.
immigrants, right?
Yep.
Like, there's like all of these things, and you go back and you look at it and you're like, oh my gosh, that's why I am this. Like, there's,
Exactly.
you can't ignore the connections. It's unbelievable. This piece is important for healing our own trauma, but I do think it's biblical, and I do
Yeah.
think that it's really important. Yeah.
Well, how could it not be biblical when the entire Bible is telling stories for generations and generations and generations?
Yeah.
I don't know, Esther. You're being a heretic and tying it all together here. Woo! I just am laughing. I'm like, okay, well, isn't that the entire Old Testament? And I was just Yeah.
thinking, you guys reminded me of how we can do that as a collective generation to past generations. And was it Rachel Held Evans and Sarah Bessie? I'm not quite sure, so correct me on that. That held space for the women in the Bible that no one talks about, like almost memorial services for like the one story I'm picturing is the girl who was cut up in 12 pieces and sent out to the tribes. And I
Yeah.
believe they had a sacred ritual honoring her. And so, like you said,
Yes.
it goes to the past. That's
Yeah.
so not woo-woo. This is just normal.
It is. It's stuff that's been pushed into the fringes and what's considered weird and woo. And here's why. Because it's work, it's healing that's driven by women and has always been driven by women.
Ooh, powerful. Wow.
Just like healing, right? Like, why were women and girls murdered during the witch? I don't even know, the hysteria of witchcraft, because they were doing work that was labeled as dark and demonic. And we're talking about primarily elderly widows who were the midwives who understood plants. I mean, they didn't have Young Living. You had to go out and figure out your own oils, right? Like, and so we see this throughout history. Anything that is women's wisdom gets pushed to the side and a lot of times gets labeled as dark and demonic,
Yes.
even though it is the most life-giving. It's that mothering. It is that most life-giving, compassionate presence that we could ever want for ourselves. One of the people that I started following very early in this sort of ancestral healing journey is Rabbi Firestone. She is a female rabbi who does a lot of ancestral healing work in the Jewish community, Holocaust survivors and their children and their grandchildren. And to listen to her book, I believe, is called From Wounds to Wisdom. And I actually attended an online seminar that she spoke at, and it broke me open
That's
in
beautiful.
the most humbling and beautiful way, and really made me say, okay, yes, I know I'm doing this work for myself, and that motivation is enough. And also, if I just pull back and look around, what's the byproduct of loving myself this way? What's the byproduct of caring for my tender spaces and nurturing places that maybe the people in my family have never had nurtured? Yeah, it's beautiful.
That's great.
We'll get right back to today's podcast episode, but we wanted to give a shout out to a few of our Patreon supporters, Laura Dian, Megan Daly, and Amanda French. Thank you so much for your support. For just $3 a month, you can be a part of our private Patreon group and help us keep the lights on at Deconstructing Mamas. And now, back to the episode.
Well, your book. Okay, let's read the title again. Deconstructing Your Faith Without Losing Yourself. And as of this airing, it is all over bookshelves and anywhere where books are sold. Came out in February, and it's a beautiful title. I know a lot of our listeners will be like, I want to get that immediately. So talk to us about why you wrote the book. I mean, we know you're a deconstructing coach, faith coach, but just give us a few glimpses into what's inside the pages, and then I'm sure we'll go from there.
Yeah, I think the biggest reason that I wrote the book is because there's so many things that I've learned, and there's so many beautiful experiences that I've had with my clients. And also, there's only so much of me, right? Like, I can't reach all of the people that I long to have healing. I can be compassionate within my circle, but the moment that I try to serve everyone through coaching or through my communities, I'm not going to be able to serve anybody, right? And burnout is a real, real risk in any, it's pastoral care. I mean, deconstruction coaching is very similar to pastoral care or nursing or, any of those things where you're really pouring into people. So the biggest reason I wrote the book was so that I could get some of this into other people's hands, especially people who it's not safe for them to talk about deconstruction, whether they're in unhealthy relationships or perhaps their job depends on them following a certain doctrine, or if they're just in really conservative spaces where there would be a tremendous backlash. Being able to access this on your Kindle or listen to the audiobook or, slip it into your purse when nobody's looking. I'm just hoping that creates a safe space for people in that moment, even if they don't have any other safe spaces, and holds that like sets that intention of I'm going to find healing for myself, even if I don't have a clue what that is. Like what I'm doing right now is not working. There's so much harm happening to me. I don't know what's on the other side of this, but let me at least start with this little piece. Let me start the conversation this way. My friend AJ says it the best, and we ended up putting it in the book. She says, we're in the wilderness. We're all in the wilderness of deconstruction together. There's no straight road through. There's lots of different paths. And the language that I can really credit to her is, come sit by my fire for a little bit and warm yourself until you're ready to go build your own fire and set up your own camp somewhere. You don't have to be anything or do anything or agree with me or explain anything. Like, let's just have this space where you can breathe and then figure out what you want to do. But breathe first.
That's so good. Your intro to your book is called Deconstruction is Not a Trend.
Yeah.
People on the outside think, oh, this is just a trend. It's going to go away and everything will go back to normal. Or they view it as the enemy. It's kind of like one of those things.
Yeah.
What's your counterpoint to that statement, deconstruction is a trend?
Well, I think you're 100% right. I think there's a lot of backlash. I think that there are a lot of people who are highly privileged in this unhealthy religious system that's so prevalent, who are very threatened by the idea of coloring out of the lines, like embracing the grayness and going back to a place where the goal isn't to be absolutely sure all the time. I think there's this myth of like certainty is next to godliness, and that is not true. Like, how can we possibly absorb everything there is to know about all of these huge things that exist in our world? And like, we're not going to master that. It doesn't matter how many years we live. So uncertainty and wonder is at the heart of any faith, right? It's just kind of how we're wired. It's just really important for people to know that the voice is saying, oh, you're just lazy. You don't want to do the work. But to be in a church community, you don't want that accountability. You just want to go sin. You want the easy way out. It's just a trendy thing. Like, yes, it's so sad, and we're going to grieve for you, and we're going to pray for you, but we're not actually going to value your experience. I want people to know that that is not the only thing. Again, in the wilderness, there's this whole bunch of people who understand the value of loosening our grip on certainty and saying, okay, what else is there? Just like with the ancestral healing, like it wasn't until I really started to unclasp my hands, unclench my hands a little bit, that I was able to say, oh, that's where that tenderness came from. That's where that fear of abandonment came from. That's why that healing needs to happen. And so it also goes like it's to us, right? To those of us in the deconstruction community, but it's also a really solid response of saying, this is a hard boundary. You can say whatever you want outside of this community, but you're not going to come in here and tell people that they're lazy because deconstruction's hard. You're not going to come in here. And I think somebody said it was like the sexy new trend. And I'm like, you have obviously not been in the trenches with snotty tears trying to work out your faith. Ben and Jerry have both been huge allies on my journey. I've consumed many a pint of Ben and Jerry's during my deconstruction. That is not sexy. That is right. Nothing about that is sexy. So I just think it's really important to kind of, I don't believe a lot of absolutes. But I do believe that each person should have the ability to explore their story without someone else saying, no, this is it, that you're wrong. This is what it should be. And I think confronting this sort of really loud, it's not even really large, it's just a really loud, venom-filled group of anti-deconstructionists who just want to leverage their power to squash it. We just have to say that's not okay. They can be whoever they want to be, but not in this space. They don't get to be in our inner circle and influence our daily lives.
One thing you said last time on our podcast was ask yourself to, the second question is the one that stuck with me. Like, who is this going to hurt and who does this benefit? It was, I forget, I think that was the second part was basically like, who does staying in whatever a certain place benefit? And who does leaving or going into a curious place harm? And those might be the people in your life that are going to be the loudest about this or call it trendy or try to discourage you or whatever. So I don't know.
And it's people, there's a lot of people with really large platforms, and there's a lot of people who, like in the book, I talk about a fortified faith being immovable. It's a fortress, it's a castle. It's not designed to move, it's designed to protect people inside. And so, like, if you think about the medieval castles, the king and the queen and their kids and all the royals, like, they have multiple layers between them and the outside. It wasn't to protect the peasants who lived outside the walls of the fortress. It was designed to protect them, right? So when we talk about flexibility and movement, fortresses are not designed to do that. So fortified faith gets really scared when we talk about, well, maybe there's some other stuff here we should be listening to. You know, like, okay, well, I notice a difference when I tend to my own wounds, and it seems to impact my grandparents who are still living, even though they don't know I'm doing this work. I wonder what that's about. Right? And being curious.
Right. It's like while you're inside the walls, you feel protected in certain ways. I mean, maybe not all the time. A lot of us deconstructed because we didn't always feel safe and protected. But when you leave, it's almost like you become unimportant. Like no longer do your feelings matter. It doesn't matter that you've been hurt. It doesn't matter that you're suffering. At least that's been my experience. Like none of those things matter, right? The only thing that matters is like you need to be either back inside the fortress or you are now an enemy. And like it's like that very black and white, right? Like some, because sometimes I wonder, I mean, I'm very empathetic and sometimes I'm on the internet and people are saying all sorts of things, fun, wonderful things to me about, you know, my new life of sin. And I just think to myself, like, how can you think that somebody who is struggling and suffering and being very vocal about that, like, how can you treat them like that? Human suffering at some point, right? Or somebody in pain has to trump doctrine at some point. Like that has to be the most important thing. But you're like, when you said that whole thing about the fortress, I was just thinking, like, wow, that's so true.
Structures or systems. A system could be a family. A system could be, you know, a team at work, obviously a church community, a denomination. Like it can, a country is a system, right? Any system that has a power imbalance is designed to protect that power imbalance. So we talked about cult documentaries, right? If you're questioning whether or not you should have stayed in your unhealthy space, in that religious space, if you're like, oh, is it really toxic religion? Was it really that bad? Go watch a cult documentary that's not Christian. Pick a different one. And as you sit there and you notice how people are pressured to assimilate, how like the gap between the insiders and the outsiders becomes greater, autonomy starts to disappear, all these things, you'll be like, oh crap. even if you weren't in a cult, like Charles Manson, what Charles Manson did, knock that down to about 15%. And that's how the majority of churches are. Of course, not all churches, but enough that we should be saying, hey, wait a second, what's going on here? So we're conditioned to do things that keep us in that system because exploiting us is what powers the system.
Yes.
So when we say, I don't want to be exploited anymore, ooh, guess what? We're a threat. Mm-hmm. We're no longer valuable to that system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like when you take a battery out of a video game controller, that battery is not important anymore. You're just going to throw it away. Same kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, so good. Can you just give us a sneak peek? We don't want to tell everybody everything in your book because we want them to go and unpack it for themselves. But how do we navigate this wilderness, this outside the camp, outside the fortress, mm-hmm. without losing maybe what feels like our core self?
Yeah.
Like who we really are underneath it all, yeah. all underneath all those systems and fortresses.
Well, the warning, I guess, it's, I don't know if it's a warning or not, but the one thing I want people to keep in mind is that humans learn from experience. So the longer you've been in an unhealthy system, the longer it's going to take you to untangle from it, right? So, you know, you could read the book, you could work with a coach, you could go to therapy, like, but this is a long, if this is a major part of your life, mm-hmm. the first thing is be patient with yourself. Mm-hmm. And just know that you have time. Even if you're 90, I would say you have time. Like there's time and there's space here because the goal isn't to be certain. The goal is to sift and sort and question and get rid of the things that you know are harming other people and yourself and see what's left. And then sit and ponder and be curious. It's not like you're plugging something into Google Maps and saying, I'm going to get from point A to point B. What's the fastest route? What's the route that has the best roads and the, you know, the best coffee shop on the way? Like that's not what it is. Mm-hmm. The reason that's so hard is because a lot of us were taught that that's what faith is. Mm-hmm. That's what Christianity is. I don't think that was done with malicious intent. I think it was like, okay, we have this amazing thing. How do we help people get it? Mm-hmm. But it got systemized to the point. It got packaged to the point where it becomes really legalistic and really checklisty. Mm-hmm. And so as you move into deconstruction, mm-hmm. if you were to, you know, kind of read through this book and summarize it all, I think the heart of it is there are some practices, there are some tools in here, there is a process, but it's not necessarily a process that gets you from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. It's not a process, like we're not doing deconstruction, we're learning how to be. So it's a being rather than a doing.
Right.
So rather than doing faith, doing church, doing all those things that quote unquote redeem us, right? Make us holy. We're stepping back and saying, okay, well, what if we're not inherently trashy, evil beings to start with? What if I peel back all these layers that are harming me? Well, crap. Look at that. There's a sacred, holy being in there.
Yeah.
There's a human that was created with love and compassion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Look at that. Like, okay, that's a completely different trajectory for life than constantly trying to outrun unworthiness and constantly being afraid of lightning bolts and being cast out and all those just horrible things that have really become central in a lot of Christianity rather than just like allegorical or, oh, yeah, that happened in that extreme case that one time, but that's not what happens every day.
Yeah, but having like, it's like having no formula. Like, that's the thing. That's like the worst part of it, right?
It
for like
is.
All of us, because we have no formula. We're all flying by the seat of our pants. And I know for me, I want an answer. Is it this kind of therapy? Is it this? Is it this? Is it this? It's so hard to step out of that space where you need
yep.
that external, right?
Mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
Esther, you were talking about, like being externally motivated or feeling like you have your own truth inside of you that's valuable.
Yeah.
Like that's like the hardest piece, I think, is being able to believe that and then live your life that way and heal that way and know that someone else's story is going to be different. And you could say, this is what works for me, but I have a different nervous system than you. And this happened to me when I was five and la, 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 la. Right. And I have to do it a different way, but that's terrifying.
Yeah. And the way that you do it is not a threat to me. That's the thing, right?
Like, yes.
So honestly, the thing that I am most proud about with this book and with my coaching practices, I am 100% committed to not telling you what to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I have some clients, I don't have favorites, but some of the clients, the favorite client sessions that I've had is where they're really wrestling with stuff and they're just like, what do you think? And I get to say, it doesn't matter what I think. What do you think? And they're just like, just give me the answer, which I totally identify with. Right. But that's the difference between actually like deconstructing your entire belief system versus just maybe deconstructing one belief and jumping into a different belief system that's not yours. Right. Somebody like, oh, this is what Angela believes. Oh, I should totally believe that. Isn't that how we all got into this place in the first place? Right. Exactly. Like, that doesn't mean that I don't believe anything. And I will openly talk about my beliefs. But when it comes down to it, if I'm here to support your deconstruction, what I believe doesn't actually matter outside of, do I believe that you have the right to believe what you want to believe? Right. Like, right. Am I here to hold space for you? Am I here to prioritize your agenda?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I just here to prioritize my agenda? Am I just creating a different hierarchy?
Right.
Because that's gross. Nobody wants that. Well, people who want power want that. Like, none of us that are in this healing space.
Well, that changes the way that we then parent too, right? Like if we no longer feel like we need this certainty, right? If we feel like we are owed our own journey and we deserve that and there's beautiful freedom and peace in that, then that's also how we're approaching our kids when we're raising them in faith or spirituality or just as regular schmegular human beings. Like it changes the way that we parent them in that. Hopefully, I think for a lot of us, our goal is not to control, but to foster an environment where they can grow and learn and they don't have to believe what I believe because they're their own people.
Yep.
Right. One thing you said, just alluded to it a little bit, you said there's not necessarily a formula, but you are providing specific tools in your book. And one of those tools you have for maybe figuring out who you are. Maybe that's the end. It's not like we're not losing ourselves. We're probably finding ourselves, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, a lot of times we exist under all of these layers of conditioning and all these layers of what we've been told we should be. And I do think that as we peel back those layers, we have a better chance of actually discovering who we would have been had all those other things not happened.
Yeah.
So for me, part of my deconstruction is like, okay, what would faith and spirituality look like for me if I hadn't had trauma? If I had a different brain chemistry, if I hadn't been exposed to XYZ. And it doesn't mean that I'm resentful of, you know, having PTSD or having, but like, it doesn't mean that I'm saying those things are awful. There are some awful things, but also how I'm wired is okay. Like,
yeah,
whatever my body had to do to get me here, I'm still here.
Yeah, that's so good.
And also, what are the dreams that I want that maybe 5-year-old Angela never wanted to give up, right? What are the joys? What are the connections? What are the things that nourish me in a way that trauma told me not to do?
You have something called buckets. Is that
yeah.
something? Can you just talk to us about buckets?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest myths of deconstruction is that you can just go out and read a bunch and figure it out.
You mean Pete N's book and Angela Harrington's book isn't going to solve
it? I know, right? Like, raise your hand. Everybody at home is probably raising their hand. Like, it's not an information issue. Because if it was, nobody would be deconstructing because there's a buttload of information out there, right? And so part of the process that I teach is how to take in information and sift it out and sort it out. And one of the most empowering things that I've done is I've told people, I use Hoarders or any other organization show kind of as an example, right? Like when you're trying to clear out someone's house and they've been there for 90 years and things are just stuffed to the rafters, they don't pick up one piece in the house and decide what to do with it, right? They start sorting it into different piles. And so we can do the same thing. And we can say, okay, this is something I still believe. And I, at least for now, want to hang on to it. This is something, this other bucket over here is maybe something that's like, I'm not ready. I am not ready for that bucket. We're going to put stuff in it. And then we're going to put it in the back of the garage on somebody else's land because I don't want to deal with it right now. Right. But then we also have this bucket of like, oh, that does a lot of harm. And that doesn't resonate with my soul. I'm going to put that in the pitch it bucket. Like, I don't want to come back and revisit that. I'm pretty sure that this is where I stand. And the cool thing about it is you don't have to make all the decisions at once. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times when we try to make all the decisions at once, we try to sort out all the issues. Like you scroll through your Facebook feed and find 100 people with things that are really important topics. And you try to decide all 100 of them while you munch on your Ben and Jerry's at 2 o'clock in the morning because you couldn't sleep. You're going to drive yourself mad. Like it's going to be overwhelming and you're going to get stuck. So if we can find ways to get connected to our body, to get curious, to start like sifting out the things that don't fit, that don't matter and don't seem sacred and holy, get rid of that bucket. Now, all of a sudden, this bucket that holds all the good things, there's room for those good things to expand. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of us don't have to reconstruct because if we're coming out of a really toxic, dangerous religion, what the heck is there to reconstruct? We don't want to go back to that, right? We don't want to build that system up again in just a slightly different form. We want to grab a hold of what is sacred and holy and clear out the clutter so the sacred and holy can expand and more of our life is spent in that space than trying to get out from under the weight of purity culture or, you know, misogyny or racism or trans homophobia, all those other things that are so awful and oppressive that they will take everything if we focus on them.
Yeah.
So we just dismantle them.
Mm-hmm.
We like, those are the things we dismantle and we can't control everybody. We can advocate, but in the still quiet moments in the middle of the night, when I'm with myself, what goodness do I want there? Right. Some people come out of deconstruction. They don't believe in God anymore. Okay. If that's where your path is, cool. What goodness do you want in the middle of the night? What nourishes your soul? I don't care what you call it.
What nourishes your soul?
You could say, I believe our creator's name is Bubba. Cool.
What was it? We had somebody that called them the giant muffin, something like that.
I've heard Sky Daddy, which I kind of like, but that feels like an ABBA disco song or something. So I'm not sure. But yeah, like,
right.
What if we just didn't label it?
Right.
And again, we just be it. Like we just experience whatever that is. And again, slow down a little bit, catch our breath, and just listen to what needs to be healed within us so that when we go out in the world, instead of pouring out more trauma on people, we're pouring out the healing. We're replicating what we have. Now, I want to make sure that people know that we're not talking about spiritual bypassing. We're not talking about leveraging our privilege to stay out of the muck. We're all white women here. We need to be on the front lines protecting people who are more marginalized by the church than we are. But that's not the same as sitting with those beliefs and holding them in the still dark moments of the night and allowing the hate and the rhetoric and all of that evil venom to suck the life out of us. It's a both and.
Yeah, both and.
We won't be any good to anybody anyway if we're sitting
yes.
ruminating in the dark at 2 a.m.
Right.
On all those things, because then they have power over us, right? Again, it's power over. Wow.
Yeah.
Your kids, like you were saying, are getting older.
Yeah.
And they've probably watched this whole thing play out for you for a long time now. What would be like your hope for them? Like, let's pick something from your book. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's pick one thing from your book. Like if they could read any chapter in your book, which one would you want them to read?
Oof. I think that out of all of the things, so here's the thing is I really hope that my kids are seeing me live out what's in here so that they can pick up what they need when they need it. So for example, what I started to, the first thing that came up was this idea of embodied curiosity. That's pretty early on in the book. And I just, wherever my kids land, I hope that that's something that they take with them. The whole process that I kind of teach in here, the practice is, I call it vulnerable exploration. And so whether they're in a work environment, they're cross country or swimming or whatever, you know, whatever, where the relationships or their faith or like all the different places, I really hope that they internalize that self-attachment and that sense of curiosity, like being in my body and being curious is sacred and holy. It's wild, which is why people like try to contain it. But like that fire in your belly that says, what if? I just hope that they take that with them. My kids at this point are old enough that they're choosing what interactions they want to have with faith. They're, you know, they're talking about colleges and careers, and some of them have already graduated. And like, I'm not doing a lot of telling them what to do anymore. Like, we're at that place where it's really like, well, let me just take a baby step back and I'm here if you need me, but they're not toddlers. So, and I mean, that stage is exhausting and there's so many beautiful things there, but it's actually a really beautiful space that I've been raising myself. I've been mothering myself as I mothered my children. And as they've gotten older, there's a little more space for me and there's a little more space for my husband that we just didn't have early in our relationship.
Yeah.
So I hope that, I mean, I hope that's what they take. My daughter actually stole the first copy that came in.
Oh, that's so cute.
She stole it and I only got it back because she wanted it autographed. So she will read it. She's all about it. She's my little feminist, but I think that's just my hope. Like, if I can send them out into the world with that little piece, they can figure out the rest. And they can always come home when they need it.
Yes.
I love that too.
There's a really beautiful line in Alanis Morissette has a song called A Blaze. And I don't know if you remember, but during COVID, she was doing it on like, I think it was Jimmy Fallon. She was doing it live streaming and her kiddo came in. And so she's standing there performing live, holding like a 3-year-old, singing this song that she wrote for each of her children. And there's a line in that that I still get choked up. She says, this nest is never going away. That's what I want for myself. And that's what I want for my children. So if they can adapt that, they can adopt that embodied curiosity and go out into the world, come home when you need it, whether it's to share wins or tend to your wounds. Like, that's what I want for all of us. It really is.
That's great. Well, Angela, thank you so much for coming on. It's been fabulous. We love this book that you put out into the world. We hope people go on. Can you just say for everybody where they can find out more about you? Just if they're curious to find out more about the book too.
Absolutely. So AngelaJHarrington.com is my website and it's HERRINGTON. There's a tab on there for the book. There's a tab on there for my free Facebook community. If you're not there yet, there's a whole bunch of blog posts, you know, how to parent while deconstructing and how do you know if your church is toxic? Like all kinds of free resources that you can take advantage of in the middle of the night when nobody's around. If that's where it starts for you, you can do that safely on that website. And then I'm on all the socials, but go to the website first. And that's where you can get the scoop on all the things. And I'd love to connect with you if it would be helpful. And if not, just know I'm sending love.
I know. I remember way back when Liz and I started, which I can't believe it's way back. It's like 2 years ago. Feels way back. You were one of the very first people that you have a fantastic research page on your website. And you were like, upcoming podcasts. And I was like, we've made it onto Angela's website. So,
yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that because there is a huge list of podcasts. There's a huge list of books. And like, if I can save somebody a couple of hours of trying to weed the stuff out on the internet that's not helpful.
Yeah.
Cool. Like I'm happy to do that labor and
so good.
Just make it hopefully a little easier than it was when I started. Cause we have a deconstruction in general has a much, much more robust community than even 5 years ago.
Yes. Yeah.
So I just hope people will take advantage of that, whether it's me or somebody else. Like, just get the support that you need, because you do really deserve healing and you deserve to be free.
Thank you.
Totally. Well, that's it for this episode of the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. We love that you tuned in and hope that this gave you a little bit of grace and space for your soul to breathe.
Don't forget to catch up on any of our episodes that you missed. And remember to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Deconstructing Mamas.
That's where you'll find all the information that you need about the podcast, as well as on our website, deconstructingmamas.com. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter when you get there.
If you'd like to support the podcast, join our Patreon network for just $3 a month and have access to our private community with all kinds of extras. Leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts or just tell others about the show.
Thanks for listening and come back again for our next episode. We can't wait to be on the other side of your headphones.